And your face lights up. I mean, I have the advantage of seeing you. Your face lights up when I say
Yeah.
that.
I like your expression, playing. Did you say playing in the passion pot?
Playing in the passion pot, yeah.
Is that one of your expressions?
No, I just made it up. My name is Paul Harvey, and this is Life, Passion and Business. We're about helping you explore, finding your passion for life and the work that you do. But it's so much more than that. It's about finding clues to the big life questions. What does it mean to be successful? What is the meaning of life? If you're looking for more, then join me on this journey, where together we will discover through interviews, tools and tips how to live life full of meaning, passion and purpose. Welcome to Life, Passion and Business. In our last program with Zoe Cohen, we got to the unusual position where I recognised the show was going to run well beyond its normal length into, and in actual fact, it went to 1.5 hours. So I took the decision to split the programme into two because the conversation with Zoe was rolling so well and I didn't want to break it. So to recap on where we are so far, I stopped at the point where Zoe had been arrested. So let's go back and explain how that is for anyone who wants to catch up. So Zoe started her career at Oxford University. She went to study life sciences. She eventually ended up in the health service and she became the youngest executive director of a health trust in the NHS at the age of 27. She went on to serve various companies at board level for over 9 years. She started her own coaching practice and she's been running that ever since. Well, actually, it was the IPCC report that actually caused a shift in her mindset and she became involved in Extinction Rebellion. And she was arrested earlier this year and she is currently awaiting the outcome of that process. So we got on through the kind of where her life travelled to, and now we're into this idea of the success model. And this is where we start. We're exploring what success means for Zoe. I think Zoe is a great example of how we're all going to have to shift our mindset in how we live on this planet. And I appreciate that it may be uncomfortable for people to hear, but the weather is changing, however you look at it. Whether you believe that's caused by human intervention or something else, the weather is changing. And if we can do something about it, perhaps we should. And it's people like Zoe that are on the front line saying, we must do something. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the conversation or the continuing conversation with Zoe Cohen. Now, you know, the success model you and I were sold, because I think we're of a similar age, is study hard, get a good job, buy the house, have this life, retire and enjoy your life. You know, what a pot of crock that is, because that is just never going to happen. So yeah. The success model you are following, you know, you are definitely playing in the passion pot. You are really absolutely here to make change in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And your face lights up. I mean, I have the advantage of seeing you. Your face lights up when I say that.
Yeah. I like your expression, playing. Did you say playing in the passion pot?
Playing in the passion pot, yeah.
Is that one of your expressions?
No, I just made it up.
That's funny. Yeah, and it's so I've always been pretty values driven. It's just been, I've been, you know, iterating around what's the core of this. And I knew, you know, as I said, I knew when my mum was dying that the core essence of my purpose and passion is planetary and environmental. It always has been. I care about other stuff as well, but they are secondary. You know, they are secondary. Obviously, I care massively about my daughter and my husband within that. But it's like my fundamental kind of drive and passion is reducing harm to the planet, and has been since I was a young child. So I've kind of come back home to that, and it's a difficult place to live, and I don't think that'll surprise anyone who's been involved in activism or following their passions, because it is a difficult, particularly in now we are so far on in the devastation that we've caused, it's a really difficult place to live because, you know, I totally don't buy into the, you know, happy clappy, just do your bit, it'll all be fine, look at all the good news, people are recycling kind of stories. You know, that story should have gone 20, 30 years ago, if not more. You know, that story is not one we can buy into, and I completely can't buy into it. So we are, you know, living on, facing into as much of the reality as possible is a really hard place to live. But enough of us have to, because everyone else isn't. You know, it's like the Greta Thunberg thing. If I'm a 48-year-old Greta, I don't know, but I wouldn't draw that analogy because it's not fair on either of us. She's an incredible person. Reality and telling the truth is really important to me, which is, I think, one of the reasons why the XR tenets and values of, you know, tell the truth and act like the truth is real is so resonating with me, because I absolutely believe it. You know, we've colluded and deluded ourselves for so long, and I'm sure more people know it than are letting on. So what is success? Success is making as much difference as possible in you know, on a daily basis, really. So, which again is quite a hard burden to carry because I don't let myself off the hook very much. But, you know, ultimately, I don't know, Paul, who knows what success is, but I do know that it felt, for at least a short while, felt really, really good to see that, for example, you know, the UK Parliament was actually having a conversation about climate emergency on the 1st of May and then agreed to that motion of climate emergency, knowing full well that none of that would have happened without what Extinction Rebellion had done in London with the Greta Thunberg school strikes. And of course, building on the history of protests and activism and were the work that had been done for decades, it's not like this came out of the blue. Of course it didn't. But equally, without a movement that would just actually cut through the crap, excuse my language, but cut through the crap and say, wake up everyone, we are heading for utter disaster and we have got to wake up now, we've got to change the system and we've got to do this in a very different way, because actually normal people have actually got to start protesting and getting arrested, otherwise things are not going to change. That just, it cut through the sleepwalking that so many of us just live in at least part of the time, and I think without cutting through that, we're just gone a long way. So I, part of cutting, you know, I kind of live in that world where I try and cut through that collusional, delusional stuff for as many people as possible on a daily basis.
And that's all you can do. You know, success is having a good conversation with one person.
Yeah, but
every day. I mean,
every day.
I know it doesn't make. You know, that's all you can do. You can.
And I don't think it is. You see,
you've got a higher value. You've got a higher set of numbers, but it's just numbers, isn't it? I mean, and your posts go out every day, and you get hundreds of comments on your posts. So you are clearly making shaking some cages a little bit.
Well, I hope so, Paul. Thank you, and that's only, I don't mean that in an arrogant way, because I'm really, really not arrogant.
Are you out there speaking in places? Are you talking?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. The LinkedIn stuff, which I've done a lot on and I do spend a fair bit of time on, is one, maybe a tenth of what I'm doing. I'm doing a whole bunch of other stuff. So,
I mean, I don't, to me, I think you need to be promoting more of those when you're speaking somewhere. I think we need more pictures of you speaking. I think we need to, I think if that's how you would change it. Because what you're doing is you're putting your face to it. At the moment, what I see you do on LinkedIn, sorry, this is my marketing hat on. I see you on LinkedIn, you present other people's content, which is great. And it does rattle cages. But I think if you're out there showing that you are at this conference, you are speaking today saying this, that shows you are really there. And I think you are there. That's why I'm having this conversation with you.
Yeah. So, I appreciate the feedback. I guess it's just so not about me.
But the trouble is people don't see it that way. They have to see people, normal people out there doing it and saying it.
Yeah. And I've resisted isn't the right word, but I've, for reasons I maybe haven't quite put my finger on, I've not, you know, what I could have done, because some people did it, small number of people, and what I could have done is posted a picture of me being arrested on LinkedIn.
Yes.
You know, I could have done. Why? What stopped me doing that? I don't know. Is it a good idea? Is it not a good idea? Is it? What's the word?
Well, it's this conversation about
virtue signaling. You know,
it's like, I don't know, but this thing is that now it's interesting. My wife and I are having this similar conversation really, because she is involved in. She's fascinated by this idea of non-violent communication and bringing people together. And in a phrase, I cannot remember the name of the work she wants to be doing. But it basically is about bringing opposite sides together to have the conversation and finding common ground. And it's this, and I've lost my thread where I was going to this. But it is this thing about when everybody sees that this person is a normal person doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
This isn't Joe Biden standing up saying this. It isn't some American politician saying this. These are normal people saying, hang on, this is just not right.
Yeah. No, I think that can and does make it. I think that's part of what, you know, why the nonviolent direct action within Extinction Rebellion, at least on mask, has had some of the impact it has, because regular, you know, at least some people in the public who have some sympathy see that normal people, that at least some of them look like them and do normal jobs, or, you know, a retired GP or a teacher or a student or whatever, are actually doing that. So, and I know when I try and talk about this stuff in as many opportunities as I can, you know, even when I know that it's very not a British thing to do. You know, we have the conversation like you and I did at the beginning of this. How are you? Fine. Yeah, fine. Well, actually, I try and bring it into as many conversations as possible, and break people out of their bubble. So I was even at the dentist earlier this week. I was at the dentist, and the hygienist was talking about recycling and how she is quite passionate about it because her son's been learning about stuff in geography at school, and I was like, I had my mouth open, I couldn't really talk. I was like, yeah. and then at the end I said, I said, well, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm actually involved in Extinction Rebellion, and I was one of the people that got arrested. And it's like when you say it to someone who's kind of, and they're like, wow, you get a wow effect of like a normal person.
Well, because that's right, because you will get a wow effect. Yeah, absolutely. What gets me on this? All right, so I've been on this journey for a long time, but it's really affected my life, because I mean, I was a traditional marketer up to 2004. I was involved in fast moving consumer goods on some level because I was involved in the retail industry. When I moved here, I had a sabbatical because I moved from London to Scotland. I had a sabbatical for 18 months, then I went back into business. But that was my transition point. I started to understand that we actually were doing ridiculous things, and I really fell out with my marketing career. I really fell out with that whole idea of fast consumption, and so that's my journey. I've been on that process for years, and now I pick the clients I work with, and I only work with people that, as far as I'm concerned, are doing something that's positive change. Or a lot of the things I work with are very much mind, a lot of services rather than products, because that's easier to deal with. But what I do struggle with at the moment is, who's in charge? Who is actually thinking about this? Because we produce so much stuff. I mean, all right, I went to an event and I was given this lanyard.
Mm-hmm.
What am I supposed to do with it now?
Just don't give it back to be reused.
It just didn't happen at the time. It was just, I could have done, but it wouldn't have got reused. It would have got binned. It's like, what is supposed to happen to this piece of kit now? Someone has produced this. It's got nylon in it. It's got metal. It's got plastic. There's paper in here. Now, and that is just one of the myriad of things that ends up sitting in my office because I don't know what to do with them. I got a new, the other day, I got a new, I can't even worry. I got a new one of these from the bank.
Oh yeah.
No,
yeah.
I stripped the old one down and see what was in it. It's a chunk of plastic inside and a pile of electronics. Okay, that I can recycle. That can go. But what am I supposed to do with this bit?
Yeah, yeah. And there's millions and millions of them.
And it's like toothbrushes.
Yeah.
You just think of the number of items that we've got.
Well, there is apparently a toothbrush recycling scheme. Apparently.
Well, they're going to have to do something. You know, it's like,
I know.
So
and we mustn't get stuck on the recycling thing either, Paul, because whilst circular economy is incredibly important, you know, the whole, one of the issues and bugbears that I have is, well, I can't speak for I can't speak beyond the UK because I, for most people I interact with, but I suspect it's spread beyond the UK. But certainly in the UK, the kind of the middle class, which is the bulk of the population, really, the kind of, you know, people somewhere in the middle,
the consumption population.
Yeah, they've kind of got the message around plastics from David Attenborough, and, you know, this plastic lineation, and, you know, kind of got the message around plastic and recycling. But the trouble is, when you talk about climate, they tend to, most people make the direct connection that, oh yes, that's, I'm doing that because I'm doing my recycling. It's like, you know, we've got that message has got across, the recycling and plastic message has got across so strongly that it, which is good, but it, but we haven't got the other messages across, because, you know, coming back to one of the key pieces about one of the key demands from Extinction Rebellion is telling the truth, you know, declare emergency and tell the truth, because people in not just the UK, way beyond the UK, people in across many, many countries are either ignorant or delusional or collusional. You know, we either don't know it or we don't want to know it. You know, right up to our friends and family, we don't want to have the truth put in front of us.
So I've made a decision in this conversation, because normally I would have tailed this podcast by now, but I think the conversation we're having is so valid, I am going to run this program into two programs. So there'll be a part two for this program.
Wow.
I think this is such an interesting part of the conversation. Now, for a very long time, prior to Extinction Rebellion, I actually thought that the powers that be actually knew we were screwed. Mm-hmm. And had actively decided to hide it from the population, mm-hmm. and just ride the baby into the ground, ride this missile into the ground, because they do not know how to change it. They do not know what to do. So they've given up and go, okay, we're just going to ride this. That's what I thought the decision had been made.
Mm-hmm.
And I think on some level it has been.
It's a really, really interesting. I don't know if there's one view, and I'm not. I hold my hands up to people who are more politically educated than I am, because I did much more science than politics, and I kind of wish I could go and do a whole other degree in politics or whatever. But anyway, you know, who's actually got control here, and is there such a thing as control? I mean, clearly we know, we don't all, but some of us know the stats around, you know, what is it, 100 corporations emit 70% of all emissions globally.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I kind of think of it as, you know, you could actually probably the sort of CEOs of the main corporations, of those corporations, plus the top billionaires on the planet, you could get them into one conference room, couldn't you? They're almost all men. They're almost all probably over 50 odd, and they're probably mostly white. They're very, very rich, and you could get them all in a room, all in a big conference room, and look them in. You know, I would love to do this. Look them in the eye. Mind you, Greta does that kind of thing on a regular basis, doesn't she? She talks to the great and the good at Davos, etc., etc. Not the great and the good, the great and the whatever. You know, you can get these small number of people with enormous amounts of power in a room. You know, what is stopping them changing? Yes.
Well, hang on. Let's unpick that a little bit, because I can understand the simplicity of just stop, but the simplicity of trying to stop a large ship moving.
It is.
If you did try and stop that, the chaos it would cause would be just immense. You said, okay, we're not producing cement as of tomorrow. We're not producing more diesel as of tomorrow. I mean, people would die in their millions. Because of those implications. It might not happen tomorrow, but it would happen. It's like, how do you control that? It's like, we've got to find a control mechanism for it. And I don't know the answers to this.
Yeah.
I just know no one's thinking about it. It's like, we've got to stop producing bits of shit plastic. We've got to turn around and say, okay, we need to make some decisions. Like, all right, I remember when the Montreal Protocol was signed and they finally decided that CFCs were killing the ozone layer.
Yeah.
They signed that protocol, and a department, I'm not sure where it was, it might have been the US, but they got together, so the best thinkers in the world, and sat down and said, right, how are we going to do this? We've got to remove CFCs out of our systems within 5 years. We've got to find alternatives for everything. And they sat down and thought, okay, what can we use for this product? What can we use for this product? And they literally went through everything, and it took them 5 years to do it, and they did a changeover. That's got to happen for this. It's the same process. Someone's got to sit down and go, right, we can no longer use that material. It's got to go. That's got to go. It's too energy dense, you know.
I agree. And obviously with this, the ozone, my own CFCs, that was specific, targeted, and an awful lot simpler than what we're talking about.
Accepted, the level of complexity. But it was a good model.
It was a good model, and it was relatively successful, wasn't it? Although I think there's been some issues with China imiting or using illegal levels of stuff more recently, but I'm not an expert on that. But yes, there, I mean, there are, you know, there's an awful lot of quotes from people like James Lovelock or other climate scientists, and what they're saying, you know, we know the solutions, we just don't use them. We don't have the political corporate business will to use them. I think we lack individual will in a lot of cases as well, but I'm not someone who pushes the individual, you know, route, because that's not clearly not enough and not sufficient. But I do think we've got to have action on all fronts, political, business and individual. But there are, you know, I'm sure you sound like very informed, Paul. I'm sure you're aware of things like Project Drawdown, you know, Project Drawdown?
No, you'd have to tell me.
Initiated by a bunch of people in the States, but I think it is international. Project Drawdown, which you can just, you know, obviously search online, is a load of work that's been done to assess the top 100 interventions against climate change.
Oh, okay.
And they've been assessed in terms of cost and impacts.
Okay.
And so they're just there online, you can see them. There's a whole, you know, the whole, we know what needs to be done. There is just, you know, we're resisting change, aren't we? And I think that I have, another thing that I'm involved in or beginning to be involved in is potentially looking to make a documentary or some sort of TV thing around, in a related topic. I'm saying this because it's off the back of what you said about lead, you know, who's talking about this, where's the leadership? And I think that the place that we find ourselves in as a species right now is the single biggest leadership challenge that we've ever faced by a million miles.
What I also think is missing is the lack of a credible alternative story. So when you look at like where the film and television takes us, most of the views we get are of a dystopian kind of culture. We never get to the resolution of how people got through this issue. I mean, you watch any of the series, you watch, you know, Star Wars, all those kind of programs, they all show cultures that are pretty much the same as we have now. They are commercial cultures and people struggling to make a living trading, whether they're trading on Earth, whether they're trading intergalactically. It's all about trade and process. No one seems to have come up with an alternative process. And it's what's missing, is people can't see where we're heading towards.
Yeah.
What they can see is sackcloth and ashes.
Sackcloth and ashes, I presume you're saying that as well, do you mean that's where we're heading because of the climate catastrophe?
Well, sackcloth and ashes is basically...
We have to give everything up, you mean, because we have to go back to...
Yeah, giving up everything up and going back to dark ages.
And I just think that's... I agree, one of the challenges is absolute paucity of political imagination and vision and leadership. And what I think there's more strands to it than what you've described, Paul. I think it's more complex and more challenging, actually.
Absolutely.
I think that one of the big pieces around this that I'm only just starting to see in the kind of stuff that I read, but it's not there yet, is that getting across the message that climate breakdown and extreme weather and the trajectory that we're on is forever now. You know, this is normal, this is forever, and getting across the message that the scale and time scales of the change that we need to make. So, you know, I think because there's so much ignorance and lack of awareness and lack of education on these topics, that there's a probably proportions of people who think that actually we can, you know, turn the light switch off, put the heating down, drive a bit less, and it'll all be okay. And either because that would be enough, or because actually, if you do that, the temperature will just drop. And it's like the sheer scale and physics of this is obviously at a planetary level is enormous. And it's turning a supertanker, which, and turning a huge, very, you know, slow moving but powerful supertanker, which is going to take generations. So I think coming back to the leadership and political challenge, there's, you know, you and I all know, and I'm sure people listening will know if you think about it, if they haven't already, that our political systems are not fit for leading us through any of this stuff. And we need systems and leaders who, we need that at many levels. We don't want single heroes. That's never going to be the right thing to do. But we need systems and leaders who have got the imagination and vision and courage beyond anything we've seen, you know, we're seeing at the moment, and also are able to construct a narrative. So coming back, you'll put back the story and what people can see and feel, construct a narrative and hold on to a narrative for decades. Because I think one of the major, major challenges at the crux of this is that many, many, many people who, you know, who live lives that they don't necessarily want to change will need to make changes to their life, and will need to do that with that. This is what I believe, feel free to challenge me. What I believe is that many, many people will need to make changes to their lives or have changes made for them, where they won't necessarily see the benefits of those changes, because it won't be till, you know, decades down the line that we'll see the benefits. And actually what the benefits will be is less worsening. So if we think about it in human psychology terms, we need to do a load of stuff where actually the benefits are less worsening. In other words, it still gets worse whilst you're doing stuff, because it will get worse. It'll get worse for years and years and years.
That's why the political system doesn't work, because system has a 5-year cycle, and this is a minimum of a 50-year cycle.
Yes, and it's not just why the political system doesn't work, it's why we're wired as humans, that our psychology and our biases and so on are really going to, you know, we have to tackle the fundamental way that certainly modern consciousness is set. You know, if we had a consciousness where we were thinking about, as it's, you know, at least the urban myth is that some indigenous peoples think 7 generations ahead. I think it's disputed whether that's the fact or not. But anyway, it's a great myth to have. If we're thinking 7 generations ahead, if we had that thinking and consciousness, we'd be in a completely different place. But, you know, many of us now think, you know, we want immediate gratification. We don't know why we should wait for anything. We want everything that we want right now. So the shift from that.
How are we going to shift people on that one? It's like, you know, I'm a plumber or a painter and decorator, and I go out and paint houses, and I get paid for that, and I put food on the table, and, you know, we aspire to 2 holidays a year, and you see what I mean? How do we change that?
Yeah. God, I wish I had the answer to that one, Paul. I do think about it quite a bit, as you can probably imagine.
But that's what's missing in a way, is what I was saying about credible alternatives. It's like when you watch all the great disaster movies from, you know, that come out of Hollywood, it's always the US that leads. It's always the US that comes up with the technical or the scientific solution to the problem. And it's always them that brings on the world powers together and everyone to be pulling together in this dreadful disaster. And of course, the disasters are always short term. They're never long term. What we need is someone to create a film or something to explain this process and show the generational process of how the earth changes. People need to see that narrative to be able to understand where we're heading. It's almost religious. It's almost, it's going to have to be spiritual and it's dry.
I agree. It is almost creating a new narrative, a new spirituality for mankind or personkind, because when I think about this stuff a lot, and it's the level of ask from where the reality of where we are now in political systems, and US and Iran and Trump and Brexit and nationalism and never mind the actual, well, not never mind, but also of course that what I feel really deeply about is the climate reality that's hitting so many people around the world right now, you know, from Chennai to the Midwest to Africa to, you know, right now people are suffering from lack of water or flooding or whatever. It's just horrendous. So I guess, you know, I presume, well, do I, you know, that why is it that governments don't want to tell us the truth? I think people have to know the truth. They have to know the truth, but I presume...
Because governments fall. When you give bad information, when you give information we don't like to hear, governments fall.
Yeah, which comes back to the...
We need consensus politics where governments can't fall, where we work to a consensus.
Potentially, and we need a level of narrative which is I struggle to articulate it because it's such a huge ask from where we are now. We need a narrative that where people understand sufficiently, and that alone is an enormous challenge. Understand sufficiently that turning the supertanker is going to be really, really long term, involve a huge amount of change. So all this stuff about, you know, we can just get away with small lifestyle changes, I think that's utter rubbish. I don't believe any of that. I think it's collusional and dangerous to say we can just get away with, you know, small lifestyle changes. I just think it's crazy. So we need an honest narrative and a story that tells us about the truth and tells us that we will, for the sake of our children, grandchildren and beyond, we'll need to do things that might not in the short term necessarily feel like they make sense, but actually they need to make sense because we need to keep doing them, and we need to keep doing them for a long, long time so that our children and grandchildren can feel at least the slowing of the catastrophes that are to come. But, you know, I've articulated this to a few people, Paul, and I feel like I'm particularly struggling to articulate it today. I don't know whether I'm having that kind of overwhelmed moment that sometimes comes, but, you know, in theory, it's doable. In practice, it's just an incredibly, incredibly challenging ask.
The point is, though, I mean, I know we keep coming back to they keep pointing out there's not enough data. But the Club of Rome met or started this conversation in 1973 when they published the Limits to Growth. And the Limits to Growth highlighted five areas: water shortage, population growth, climate change, pollution, and another, I can't remember the one. And
agriculture, land.
Land, that's it, soil erosion. Yeah. And we are tracking all of their figures absolutely to the worst case scenario. So it's not as if this stuff wasn't predicted a long time ago.
Yeah. And we
physically can't keep growing at 3% a year. There's just not enough planet to do so. But at the same token, yeah, it is possible to do stuff about it, as you say. We've got, but it's political will, it's leadership, and it's getting the ordinary people on the street to support it.
Yeah, I think it's different perspectives on that as well, Paul. Because you know that the some of the research that Extinction Rebellion colleagues draw on around social movements and non-violent direct action and what's achieved social change in the past over history. You know, the work by Erica Chenoweth at Harvard just talks about how you need a maximum of 3.5% of the population to actively engage to get system change. So, you know, in terms of actually people being actively engaged in the movement, you don't need everyone. You can get system change, and there's examples of that through history and relatively recent history. So, but I guess because of the way my brain works and the way I'm wired, I think about long term and big picture as well. And so I think, yeah, okay, there's one thing getting the initial kind of regime or system change or the initial piece. And because of the way we're structured politically and socially and whatever, one can foresee a time when, you know, years ahead, stuff starts to happen and there's a backlash, you know, for whatever reason, there's a backlash and we don't hold strong to the past.
Well, what will happen is politicians will lose their nerve and they'll change, they'll step back. Look at the rebellions in France. You know, the yellow jackets in France reacted to the higher diesel costs, and they were put in to reduce pollution in France.
Then we bring in all the kind of inequality stuff, don't we? The enormous levels of inequality in society. You know, we've got to look at that in the face.
Well, that's what happens. That's the other problem. You know, turning this super tanker around won't affect the elite people. It will affect the people at the bottom of the food chain.
Potentially, yeah, and that's sort of the whole transition stuff comes in. You know, we have to have a just transition, and not only do we have to have a just transition because it's right, we have to have a just transition because it won't work without one.
No, absolutely.
But there's also this piece around, you know, I'm sure you'd have heard on that, apparently, I think there's a fair bit of evidence for it that, you know, a lot of the British billionaires have been building their bunkers and all of that kind of stuff. You know, where they think they can go. I mean, you know, once we get to 2 degrees C or thereabouts, as the scientists say, we're going to be in a hothouse earth, runaway climate change situation where whatever we do will make no difference. And so once, you know, if we hit that, it doesn't matter how big your bunker is, how luxurious your bunker is, you're a goner. So, you know, it's irrelevant.
But you can live out your days in relative comfort.
Maybe. What would that do for one's mental health?
Not a lot.
I would much rather go than be
in that. It's a bit like in the 70s and 80s when people were thinking about building nuclear shelters. And so it's like, you know, what are you going to do when the nuclear winter hits? Well, go into my bunker and come out in 6 months.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's all passed over. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, you know, that's at least slightly comprehensible, but sort of. But this ain't comprehensible, because once we hit that, you know, tipping point, and we're in a tipping cascade that I'm sure some people, once we get to tipping cascade, that's it. It's game over.
Yeah, once the methyl hydrate starts coming up from under the sea, then we need to give it all up, really. Basically, that's the end. Anyway, look, let's not go down that one, because we're diving down a dark hole here.
So
what is the one question that I haven't asked you?
Oh, Paul, I love questions about questions. I use them a lot. There's millions, isn't there?
This is the opportunity for you to say what you like. Not that you haven't already. Not that you haven't already.
I'm kind of thinking, God, have I said what I meant to say? What have I missed out that I should have talked about? There's probably loads of stuff I should have talked about. I guess that...
All right,
I guess the question, given that we start to go down a dark hole, which is easy to do potentially, there's the question of, you know, I don't know, I hopefully lots of people will listen to this and get something from it, but there's the kind of, well, what can we do? What shall we do? We're individuals, what can we do? Because I think so many people feel powerless or unempowered, disempowered.
Yes, unrepresented and powerless.
Yeah, and that's really widespread. I think it's really widespread and endemic, isn't it? From those people who genuinely don't have a lot of power, right, through to people who, at least on the surface, you know, live in, you know, middle-class people in rich countries, and you think proportionately, globally, you've got a massive amount of power. So I think there's, I think that... frankly, anyone who's listening to this, by dint of the fact that they are listening to it, they're in a country that's got the facilities to listen to it, and they've got the time to listen to it, bless you for listening, but it actually means that everyone listening has got a lot of power to use to enable to make a difference, because when we actually think about it, so I've been through a process of analysing my life and creating, you know, action out of that, both on the front of, you know, doing even more within my life personally to reduce my impact, obviously, but then also thinking about what are all the pieces of, how do I analyse my life to think about all the intersects that I have, what are all the communities, the professional bodies, the organisations, etc., audiences, etc., that I can impact on, or I have a connection with, that I could use to influence for the better, for the good. Mm. So, you know, and that's basically the journey I've been on for months now is, and I've got a little mind map of it, and I kind of, you know, just dissected the audiences, and they're diverse, from professional organisations to, you know, the local authority where I live, to the international coaching community, to, you know, etc. So actually, anyone who's in a position to listen to this is likely to have be in the same kind of position, that actually you have a bunch of communities locally, nationally, potentially internationally and globally that you could influence, and you could start speaking up and telling the truth.
One thing I think people can do is just ask their political leaders the question, what are you doing about this? Where
yeah, do you... but I do think, I agree. But
because it's like it puts them on the spot.
No, I agree, Paul, but I think we need to aim for much more than that. And I think, you know, again, I think there are an awful lot of people, not proportionately, because I know a lot of people are seriously just focusing on putting bread on the table, but I do think there are people who have lives where they have much more space than purely worrying about putting bread on the table. I do think there are chunks of people, there are, you know, there are bunches of people who are retired and all the rest of it, or who are working part-time, or who have sources of income that mean that they could spend a lot more time doing other stuff, and they're not doing. And I just think that actually, if we are in the position where we have time, effort, resources, space, brain space, emotion, whatever to give to this, this is what we should be doing. I can't see a moral argument.
So how would they do that? So this is the point where, what, you know, it's like, what do you want from people? There are people listening to this podcast who might want to get in touch with you. Why should they do that? What do you want?
Okay, what do I want? Gosh.
Do you want people to connect with you?
Yeah. So if I just focus it on this, I would be really happy for people to connect with me. I don't mean this in a salesy way, because I'm not really trying to sell anything, although obviously you have to live, but you know, that's a minor point. I have a bunch of a lot of thought stuff on this. I have some thought leadership, and I have some models and tools to help people. So I have a model or an approach that I've developed for the Climate Conscious Coach that I'm putting out there with the coaching community in the next few months. I have a parallel sort of model and approach for a climate conscious leader, and I also have one for the climate conscious citizen. And they're just really simple things, but just to identify the domains of our life where we can make a difference.
Yes.
You know, from making a difference with ourselves, so educating ourselves, making a difference in our own life, with our families, with our communities, with our with our political energies and time,
yes,
with our businesses, if we work in one or own one or run one or whatever. You know, there are so many dimensions in which we can make a difference, and people need to remember that every day is an opportunity to make a difference, every conversation is an opportunity to make a difference, and frankly, every pound we spend, or ideally don't, is also an opportunity to make a difference, because every pound, dollar, yen or whatever causes harm, pretty
yes.
much.
Yes.
So, you know, I really want people to bring this reality to the centre of their consciousness. And it's difficult and challenging, but yes. also it's the truth. And I think that gives us an opportunity, whatever happens, to live out our days in an ethical and moral way as much as we can. And what more can we want as sentient creatures to do than that?
Yeah. I say, on a personal level, I now cycle to the shops all the time. I don't take the car shopping.
Great. Fab.
I am now actively taking all of my plastic back to the supermarket. All this stuff that they can't recycle, that says not currently recycled. Fine, yeah. then you have it.
good. Nice little act of rebellion. Like
yeah,
that.
And I've now started a garden somewhere, so I've now started growing stuff. But it's a bit slow.
Yeah, I think growing stuff is so important. I mean, we've had an allotment for like 7-8 years, and I find it really, really therapeutic. But it's very connected. It's important to connect with the earth. You know, one of the things that we could have talked about, we could have a whole other podcast on, Paul, could be how we've lost connection with the earth.
Well, that will be our next conversation, Zoe. I think
we'll
talk again.
but thank you.
How would people connect with you? I mean, I'll put links to what's the best way to connect with you?
LinkedIn is cool. Obviously, if people are international listening to this, then LinkedIn's easy. I've got my contact details on LinkedIn, so messaging me via LinkedIn is probably the easiest.
Well, we'll do that then. So my final question to you, and this is the big question, the one question that everyone has their own personal answer to. So we are born onto this earth as animals, but we are the only animal on this earth that thinks we know what we're here for. So what are we here for, Zoe? What is the meaning of life for you?
Yeah. I'd love to know whether that statement's really true. Are we really the only animal that thinks we know what we're here for? I'm not sure that is true necessarily, but anyway, we have this anthropocentric view of life I really don't like. So what are we here for?
What's the
Well,
meaning of life for you?
I set my own kind of cosmology and orientation back at the age of about 12, which is possibly weird, but anyway, I did, where I set myself at my intention of living with doing as little harm to the planet as possible. And I'm not sure I think there's any more purpose than that, you know, living our lives whilst doing as little harm as possible. I'm not religious. I don't believe there's a God. I don't believe there's a big mummy or daddy up there that's going to save us or help us or guide us. I am a pretty spiritual person though. So I do think there is, you know, a spiritual connection and consciousness, and I believe there's an awful lot of spirituality and connection in other creatures, in plants and animals that are non-human. I don't think we have an end purpose as such. I think that actually, when it comes down to it, all that there really is love.
Yes.
And
love is a good one.
I think it sounds like a song, that it puts it in a song, but love is all there is. And I think that, you know, when one gets to an age where one has either had the privilege of creating a life and bringing one into the world, or experiencing losing the people that you love the most, that's what you know.
Yeah, it is. Well, Zoe Cohen, thank you so much for your time today. It has been a delight to talk to you, and you now have the accolade of being the longest podcast I've ever done. But that was partly my fault, which allowed it to happen. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I'm really curious about what our lovely audience might think of this, and I'd love to hear some comments, feedback and challenges, as always.
Sadly, so. With podcasts, no one tells you anything. You never
I know.
It goes out into the ether, and you know that people have downloaded it, but that's about all you know. So listen, podcast listeners, talk to us. Tell us what you think, because we would. Anyway, thanks again. And I will be in touch at some stage, but this podcast will go out shortly. And I said we'll do it in two halves. Anyway, thank you very much for your time.
Take care, sweetheart. Bye.
If you've enjoyed this program, can I ask you to like, follow and share, or better still, comment? I would love to hear your thoughts and opinion. I want to share this podcast because I think if everybody answered the three questions for themselves: what am I passionate about? What is my success model? How do I determine success? And what is the meaning of life for me? If we all knew the answers to those questions, we'd all have a much better journey, and maybe the world would be a better place. So if you can share this message for me, I would be most appreciative. As always, thank you for your time and attention, and I will catch you later.